Welcome to the Information Security Forum podcast. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert, and today we are presenting the next in our series focusing on human-centered security, and in particular, how human vulnerabilities are exploited. ISF Managing Director Steve Durbin, as always, is in the studio with me today. Hey, Steve. Nice to have you back.
Thanks, Tavia.
Steve, last time we discussed cognitive biases or thinking errors and the real vulnerabilities they can present in the information security sector. Today, I'd like to discuss with you how such psychological vulnerabilities present attackers with opportunities to influence and exploit humans for their own advantage. Attackers can use social power to trigger these thinking errors, thereby manipulating targets into making errors that are exploited for malicious purposes. Something I found astonishing from your research is that in 2018, 91% of attacks came in through email. And of that number, only 10% of email-based attacks were malware. The methods of psychological manipulation used by attackers have not just moved online since humans entered the digital era, but today's attack techniques are more sophisticated, cost-effective, and expansive, allowing attackers to effectively target individuals or to attack on a considerably larger scale.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So let's take a look at some of these attack techniques that use the method of social power to exploit human vulnerabilities, because as you just pointed out, they are on the increase. Mm. Now, attack techniques can be highly targeted or conducted on scale, but they typically contain triggers which are designed to evoke a very specific cognitive bias, so resulting in a predictable error. Mm. The threat is rarely these days a malware spray and pray any longer. Mm. You know, it's very much more sophisticated. It is socially engineered, and they're becoming more prevalent and certainly more successful. And attackers have realized that it's far easier to target humans, us people, than trying to attack technical infrastructure, which has had a lot more money spent on it and certainly has developed, I think, to a degree where why would you bother to try to attack infrastructure when there's a softer target, which is the user, the likes of you and I.
Mm-hmm. CrowdStrike's Adam Myers puts it like this. The whole idea is why invest hundreds of thousands of dollars to build your own malware when you can just convince somebody to do something stupid?
Yeah, that's right. You know, attackers use the ever-increasing volume of freely available information from online social media sources to establish believable personas and backstories in order to build trust and rapport with their targets. And this information is carefully used to heighten pressure on the target, which then triggers a heuristic decision-making response. Attack techniques are used to force the target to use a particular cognitive bias, resulting in a known error. So we're trying to anticipate, if you like, and persuade the person that's being attacked to behave in a certain way so that we can respond accordingly from the attacker standpoint. And then we can better exploit the opportunity that that creates from the attacker perspective.
In our last episode, we mentioned optimism bias. And I have to admit, I'm feeling a little bit of optimism bias right now because it just seems so dark and so malicious that there are individuals setting out to attack other people. It's kind of, I feel like this will never happen to me. So I'm glad that I know about optimism bias so I can become a smarter pessimist. This leads me to another alarming statistic from the ISF's research. 90% of attacks were targeted through such techniques as impersonation, CEO fraud, and spear phishing. And you can hear the smile in my voice, even though it's not a happy topic. It just seems astonishing. Not all of those attacks were successful, of course, but many, many attacks were and are. So how are attackers achieving high rates of success in these ways?
Well, probably one of the easiest ways to answer that is to work through a scenario.
Okay.
So a fraudulent email, one seemingly from perhaps the chief operating officer. This is a scenario that any of us, without being properly guarded and trained, could be susceptible to. So the email comes in with a company signature. That legitimizes the request. Let's say Alice, the COO, emails Bob, an employee with high levels of responsibility. This message is, on the surface, seemingly legitimate or sent from someone Bob perceives to have legitimate power. So Alice says, Bob, I need a payment transaction completed by close of business. Can you do this? I'll send the account details over. Now, listeners to our last episode, where we walked through thinking errors in detail, might pick up on what happens to Bob when he receives an email that looks urgent, one that provokes an emotional rather than a rational response, or, if you want to get technical about it, triggers the effect heuristic, that emotion-first impulse that overrides our thinking ability, our rationality. When Alice soon emails Bob again, saying, "Bob, are you available to do this? The CEO is absolutely insistent that this is completed by close of play today," in increasing the pressure by mentioning the CEO, the attacker is now moving to exert referent power. This kind of power uses the cult of personality to manipulate individuals into following their idols blindly. We see this a lot because of the cult of celebrity. So high-profile personalities who are in high regard by their followers can be impersonated online by attackers masquerading as that personality in order to easily manipulate their targets. But it shows up in this scenario as well, and it's just as manipulative and damaging. So the reference to the CEO confirms Alice's demands in the eyes of the target, Bob. Mm-hmm. Bob, under pressure, at the end of his workday, takes the next steps to accomplish the task, and in this instance, makes a good enough decision rather than a well-thought-out one, or an example of what we discussed last week, that bounded rationality, or a good enough thinking error caused by a time constraint. Next, Alice sends Bob detailed wire transfer instructions, referencing an existing supplier. The reference to an existing supplier confirms that the transaction may be real. Mm-hmm. So the exertion of informational power is effective because it uses privileged information, such as that existing supplier reference, to convince targets that the attacker is credible because they know things that only a credible source would know. For example, during a fraud campaign, an attacker may target an employee using specific company information to convince their target to share privileged company financial details. In this instance, when Bob receives the message, like all humans, he relies heavily on, or anchors on, the first or most profound piece of information given, or that supplier name in this instance, which eases then any concern because it creates that sense of familiarity.
Right.
The last step before Bob makes a financial transfer is Alice's just before close of business final email. Now, typically, it'll have a subject header that says urgent response needed. And the mail could say something like, "Bob, the supplier has demanded that we change the IBAN. This needs to be actioned as soon as possible. We cannot be late with this transaction. Please confirm when complete."
That's a lot of pressure.
It's a huge amount. And this is a blatant example of coercive power, where we're leveraging fear and punishment to manipulate human behaviour. So Alice is invoking a sense of urgency. The threat of a late transaction heightens stress. And what is a natural outcome is that Bob makes the error of decision fatigue. All these psychological pressures are cumulative and very, very effective. And finally, the transfer is accomplished.
I'm curious, do you think that security leadership is aware, or people within an organization are aware enough of these sorts of power plays, that had Alice been a legitimate COO with a legitimate request, and had Bob been more skeptical, more wary, and asked for more information, are we training people to understand and accept those safeguards? What I'm getting at is, would Alice be irritable, short-tempered with Bob? Were she making a legitimate request, and were Bob going through more security protocols to double-check, double-check, double-check? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do. And I think this is where some of the challenge comes in from the individual perspective, because the smart attacker will probably have been watching some of the language that Alice uses in her emails for a period of time. So this isn't, as we've said, you know, somebody who's immediately coming onto the network and committing an attack and then escaping.
Right.
What we see is that people are probably sitting there just watching, listening, learning.
Huh.
And so emulating the language that Alice normally uses. So if Alice normally uses fairly aggressive, emotional language, that would be reflected in the email. Mm-hmm. The recipient is then going to identify that with Alice because that's Alice's tone of voice.
Right.
So it becomes very difficult for the user to be able to differentiate. So from a security training standpoint, what we probably then want to do is have the recipient of that attack email conduct some other form of clarification. Maybe in a phone call, maybe in walking around to Alice's office, perhaps, to check that she's in. So it isn't about just, you know, validating one source. It's about encouraging, I think, our users to be a little bit more skeptical. And if something seems a little bit off, then giving them ways of just validating that that are relatively simple. And picking up the phone is probably one of the easiest. But certainly, you know, if you happen to be working in close proximity, just taking a look to see if that Alice actually is there, or just stopping by and asking the question. But that's the sort of training that we now need to be moving towards.
Well, and it enforces to me that you don't just train at one level of your organization. At Bob's level, you train at Alice's level as well to be receptive to those secondary safeguards being checked in with.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that if you were talking about, you know, risk management in an organization, there will probably be certain parameters, again, that if we're asking about fairly small transfers, you might not want to go through that degree of clarification. But certainly when we're talking about some of the larger scale ones, where something changes at the last minute, you know, the IBAN changes,
right,
that happens.
Mm-hmm.
We know that happens. But what you want to do is to really give somebody the confidence that it's okay within the organization to question.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we want to get to. It's okay to question.
Yeah. You know, nothing in the scenario you laid out is outrageous. It seems like those attack techniques are some virtually any person could fall for.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that attackers are also using online the types of tactics that one might fall for in everyday life, or power plays that rely on rewards or on ego stroking even. Do you see those kinds of manipulations?
Yeah, absolutely we do. I mean, attackers very often use basic manipulations of exerting the power of the promise of reward, you know, incentivizing targets to complete a task by promising that there will be a reward of some sort if the task is complete. So, for example, 419 scams typically incentivize targets by promising financial rewards, and power that manipulates one's ego is also really effective. And we see that when an attacker utilizes expert power, so impersonating an individual who's seen to possess in-depth information, knowledge, expertise, for example, using technical jargon to give the impression that the attacker is an expert and really should be trusted. For someone in a position of less power or authority, or perhaps who isn't as confident to question an expert, well, that kind of natural resistance, skepticism, and confidence, I think, really needs to be cultivated, really needs to be encouraged across your team, because otherwise, you know, you do leave yourself open to this kind of attack.
Well, you've talked us through that scenario of a spear phishing attack, but I know that there are other attack techniques that I think our listeners need to be fully aware of. Can you walk us through some of those other techniques?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, the most familiar is that kind of spear phishing, as you say. But we've also seen a number of others, all of which work because of the exertion of power over the target. So one that I think we're seeing more of is whaling. So this is a type of phishing email targeting a single high value target, typically a senior executive or somebody with privileged access. Attackers will, as I was saying earlier, typically play the long game, so use methods of social power over an extended period of time, and then, you know, often use expert power to establish credibility, attempting to trigger a herd behavior or reaction, or use coercive power in the form of blackmail in return for receipt of privileged information. So that's whaling. Baiting is another one. We reference this along the way as well. In many ways, it's similar to phishing. But what distinguishes baiting from other types of social engineering is the promise of an item that hackers then use to entice targets. So baiters may offer users, I don't know, free music, movie download, if they surrender their login credentials to a certain site. And you know, we've probably seen some of those things ourselves outside of the workplace. And this type of attack uses reward power to draw targets in before triggering the effect heuristic.
Right.
Tailgating is another one.
Not
football related at all. Very opportunistic form of attack. It's also known as piggybacking. So these types of attacks involve someone who lacks the proper authentication following an employee, for instance, into a restricted area. Attackers can also leverage legitimate power to persuade the target to let them into restricted areas, wearing official uniforms, creating, you know, branded logos, fake passes. The availability heuristic tends to be triggered during tailgating as targets make a judgment on the likelihood of the attacker causing a security incident. So somebody who is particularly self-confident, for instance, is much more likely to be able to tailgate or piggyback effectively than somebody who's a little bit more reticent, a little bit more concerned.
Sure.
Two others that it's probably worth us just covering briefly. Smishing. This is social engineering via text message. And we think that this is likely to become very much more popular as users have become more aware of traditional email-based phishing attacks, but less aware of text message attacks. I mean, the usage of mobile phones has increased exponentially. So this provides another means for attackers to use coercive power or reward power, potentially triggering optimism bias. Smishing attacks are currently less common. Targets are unlikely to perceive this type of attack technique, therefore, as a real threat. So it is very effective when when it's used. And then the last one, which has seen probably the greatest increase over the last 3 to 4 years, is vishing. And this is social engineering using voice. So attackers can apply any number of social power techniques using their voices to build rapport and trust instead of using email or text message, triggering the effect heuristic or bounded rationality biases through the intimacy of a direct phone call. And indeed, as the capabilities of AI, artificial intelligence, grow more complex, we're expecting to see AI chatbots becoming increasingly believable in this space. And so that means that artificially intelligent vishing attacks are likely to be something to watch out for. Now, as with a lot of other attacks we've talked about in the past, Tavia, of course, it's often the combination of some of these things that makes them very much more powerful. So for me, if we think back to what I was saying about introducing in the scenario of Alice and Bob, perhaps a failsafe where Bob would pick up the phone, one of the ways of countering that might be through vishing. So if I were Alice, pick up the phone to Bob once I'd sent some of these emails and just confirm that I actually wanted the transaction to take place. From a Bob point of view, now we've moved into the realm of it being exceptionally difficult to actually work out in our own minds whether or not this is real or not. And so it's that sort of combination that I think that's going to really make some of these attack techniques even more effective than they are today.
Vishing and smishing sounds so adorable, but they're just really not.
Yeah, vishing, smishing, piggybacking, you know, it's all they're all cuddly things, aren't they?
Did you get that transfer that you texted last night? We should, when we're off mic, I'll confirm, but it was a lot of money, but the reward was so interesting. I think that the scenarios that you're offering here are so valuable because when you put this all in context, it becomes really painfully clear that any one of us is vulnerable to these exertions of social power. So for information security programs to become more human-centered, more successful, organizations must become aware of these cognitive biases and their influence on decision-making, acknowledging that those cognitive biases, those thinking errors, are arising from normal working conditions, but also acknowledging that attackers will use these carefully crafted techniques to manipulate for their own benefit. Organizations that understand this can then begin to address information security programs to improve the management of human vulnerabilities and to protect their employees from the huge range of coercive and manipulative attacks. Now that we see the effectiveness of social power in attack techniques, let's next discuss in our next episode how to manage those human vulnerabilities. In the meantime, listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review it, and we'd love it if you'd share it in your networks. Be sure to visit securityforum.org to join the conversation on our LinkedIn group, access the show notes, and download ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance relating to this discussion. We'll be back soon. Thanks for listening.